Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Back in the day, the United States was considered the cutting edge place to be in the sciences, technology, engineering, and math. And many of us grew up with nightly doses of news about the space program and the wonders to come in the 21st century. The so-called computer science geeks of the 1970s became the whiz kids who ushered in a sea change of information technology that reaches into virtually every home, every classroom, hospital, and business. But these days, we're told that not enough students aspire to the sciences, technology, engineering, and math, and not enough of those who do succeed. Others insist that the jobs really aren't there, that students who do stick with it are not prepared to actually compete in the job market, and that they are also competing against a growing stream of cheaper foreign workers. Joining us now to talk about the disconnect is former chancellor of the Ohio Board of Regents, also a former Ohio State Senator, and a former member of the U.S. House of Representatives, Eric Fingerhut. And Eric, you're now Vice President of Education and STEM Learning at Battelle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be here.
To our listeners, are you pursuing a career in the STEM disciplines? Do you think you're being prepared to achieve your goals? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Eric Fingerhut, the talk these days is how to increase the STEM majors in colleges and universities to ensure our country remains competitive in the global economy, but there's plenty of disagreement about whether that is the problem. Often cited is the National Academies of Science 2005 report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, which describes an educational system unable to fill the need for STEM workers. But there's another study from the National Academies that same year, actually. It said the shortage wasn't one of homegrown scientists, but of viable career opportunities for them. And it's easy to find examples of unemployed PhDs. We always hear those horror stories out there. And well-educated engineering grads making $45,000 or $50,000 a year. So what's the real problem, in your opinion?
Well, I think that when we talk about STEM jobs, we really have to take a step back and appreciate the technological revolution that is underway in our economy. We have a habit. Statistics it takes a while for the government-collected statistical categories of STEM jobs to keep up with the dynamism of the technological revolution in the economy. So if you're just counting traditional scientists, bench scientist jobs in, say, a pharmaceutical company, no, you're not seeing the same level of growth that we might have seen in recent decades. But if you look at the economy as a whole, look at the financial services industries, look at the retail services industries, look at all of the manufacturing industries. These are incredibly sophisticated technological environments. Cybersecurity and financial services, all your listeners know. Do you carry money anymore very much? It's all being moved digitally around. People are trying to break into to your accounts all the time. There's people trying to fight back, the ATM machines, all the types of things that we take for granted. These are deeply sophisticated technological environments. And so, in fact, across our economy, from the manufacturing floor, where you have to program a digital lathe, to the companies making the ATM machines, to the retail environments where they want to make sure they have their products delivered on time, you know, to the right stores in the right place, and all of that is requiring a level of STEM, what we call STEM sophistication and competency across the economy that exceeds anything that we've seen in the past. And so when we talk about STEM, the need for more STEM students, we're really talking about two things. Both, yes, we need more to major in computer science and computer engineering and the various things that I've just described. But we also need a broader STEM competency across our entire workforce so that whatever company you find yourself in, whatever industry especially you find yourself in, you can relate to the growing technological sophistication and help that company see the opportunities for them in a technologically sophisticated economy.
Are you talking about even a history major, even a law student, even someone coming out of
Absolutely. So I work for Battelle. I have the privilege of working with this great organization. We have about $6 billion of research under management, maybe 25,000 scientists and engineers and technological folks. But we also, among those employees, we have lawyers and we have accountants and we have HR and we have support folks. But they all need to understand the technological business, the scientific business that we're in order to help us succeed. Go into a fast food restaurant these days, and sure, you've got folks who are, you know, running the front counter and have to do the hiring, but the entire environment they're operating in is a highly sophisticated environment. So I think that whether you're a history major, whether you're a liberal arts major, these folks are all going to find that the businesses that they're in, creative businesses, advertising businesses, communications businesses, they're all going to find that they need to have a pretty high level of sophistication on technology.
Okay, so that's great, but it's hard to pursue STEM studies. It's tough stuff for a lot of people. So you want some kind of payoff at the end, and if the payoff at the end is a minimum wage job at McDonald's, that doesn't really cut it. So you're saying that all these different workplaces have these really high demands for technological comfort, at least, and yet where's the payoff for people, even though the education and a lot of the curriculum remains the same?
Right. Well, I think the payoff is there, but we do have to appreciate that the jobs that you used to be able to access with a basic high school education are not going to pay the level that they used to, and that there is a higher level of education needed to get what used to be a basic job. That's partly due to global competition, right? We do have places where in the world where jobs for unskilled workers can go that are cheaper, and it's partly due to the increased sophistication of the environment. So let's take basic manufacturing, for example. The what goes on a factory floor these days, in order for that factory to be competitive in making high quality products at a price that they can sell it around the globe, is a highly again, if I keep using the term sophisticated, but there's no other, I can't think of a better word. These are machinery that are complicated to program, to operate. You're not actually running, making products as much as you are maintaining and programming machines that are making products. And those jobs do pay a good, middle-class wage. But frankly, you might have been able to get that wage 10 years ago without the educational level that you need today. You do need a higher education level to just get that, to get those good middle-class jobs even on a factory floor. That is what has changed in our economy because of technology and because of the globalization of the economy. And we have to reflect that in our education systems to not be honest with students and with workers and tell them that this is the skill level that's necessary in order to earn a good living wage to support your family is to do a disservice to folks.
My guest is Eric Fingerhut. He's Vice President of Education and STEM Learning at Battelle. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So a lot of kids coming up into the university system these days, they've grown up with computers. They have a familiarity with it that you and I, we don't have that familiarity. But we continue to, we have a lot of learning to do. But they come to it ready to go. But that's not good enough?
Well, they certainly are more computer literate than we are. Mm-hmm. But how you do the programming, how you do the coding, how you do cybersecurity, these are still subjects you have to study and you have to learn. I think it's worth mentioning, Anne, about our education systems, because so up till now we've been putting it a little bit on the student, on the worker, and on the business. Business technology moves fast, and business moves fast to keep up with technology and to keep up with global competition. Fact is, education tends to move slower. We tend to change slower. First of all, it takes a while to implement new curriculum. It takes a while to train new, you know, to put people through new programs. And so there, frankly, it tends to be a gap between what's needed in industry and what is being done on our higher education, at our higher education institutions, and even in our K-12 institutions. And so what the STEM education movement is about, and there's really a national movement growing, and it's, look, it is... Studies like Rising Above the Gathering Storm do prod you forward, but this is being driven by people with a passion who know that we need to improve the way we're teaching and learning. We need to adapt it to the students of today who are more technical, you know, who come with a greater computer sophistication, and it's all about accelerating our changing curriculum and our teaching methods to make sure that we are, in fact, preparing students for the way the economy is today, as opposed to the way it was when we were teaching 10 years ago. That requires constant change. We tend to be a little slower in education in doing that, but I think there's a movement underway to accelerate it.
So how do you change it, though, and still maintain the credibility of the academic environment and that sort of thing, and all of the... you know, the tried and true methods that have worked for so long?
Well, there's a couple of things that we're learning very clearly. The research and our experience in our programs is showing us. One is there's an acronym, of course, called project-based learning. There's an acronym for everything, PBL, right?
But the bane of my existence.
right. Education is really, you know, we are acronym rich. Mm-hmm. But basically what it means is that we know students learn better, learn difficult technological, even math and science concepts, when they see it applied to a problem in the real world. So what we're getting better at is taking those mathematical formulas and those scientific principles and showing students right away, integrating in the classroom right away, to how that, what does that mean in terms of how somebody uses it? How does an engineer use that principle to build something? How does a scientist use that principle to do an environmental study to improve air quality, or to how does it apply to a cyber attack that might come in? Really a huge amount of help from business in this area, where they bring in people and help us demonstrate the efficacy. Co-ops and internship programs are clearly an enormously positive way with positive benefits to teaching these STEM fields. So we know that. A second thing we know is that the siloed learning, going from chemistry to biology to computer science, engineering, 45 minutes here, 45 minutes there, that's frankly pretty obsolete in today's world. So an integrated curriculum is necessary. A third thing I'd mention and last is there's a real move towards what we call mastery-based educational systems. That's what we do at the Metro School here in Columbus, the Metro High School. And that is that students work on subject matter until they master it. If they master it faster than the normal seat time, the normal year would take, then they get to move on. If it takes them longer, we keep working with them until they move on, because until you've mastered one level of knowledge, you can't really successfully move on to the next. To give somebody a C and say, oh, you learned 70%, now go on to next year, they're just going to be farther behind than they were before. So mastery-based, integrated learning, project-based is showing enormous results in terms of more students succeeding and wanting to succeed in STEM fields.
And all of those concepts, though, are almost anathema to the factory-style education system we have going in the United States today.
Well, that's right. And I think that one of the things that I would hope your listeners would take away from our conversation is, in Ohio and now across the nation, Battelle manages something called the Ohio STEM Learning Network, which is a network of schools and programs across Ohio. We also manage the Tennessee STEM Innovation Network, because Battelle has the privilege of managing Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee on behalf of the federal government. And so we've been invited to lead the Tennessee STEM Innovation Network. And we manage something called STEMX, which is a national group of state STEM schools and programs 13 states belong to it now. And what we see, Anne, is tremendous innovation out there. There are people doing great things in education, in STEM education, that are seeing real results. And our job, is, but you know, with Battelle's support, is to see that those programs grow, get to scale, continue to achieve the support they need. And so, you know, we're really a glass half full, folks on STEM education. We see the challenges that you described at the beginning of this segment, but we can also tell you and tell your listeners that there are creative, great things going on out there. And the glass is half full. We're solving this problem, but we've got a ways to go to get it to scale.
Well, let's go back to a little bit of the problem. The opinion out there that the dearth of homegrown talent has shaped national policy, permitting companies and universities to import tens of thousands of foreign scientists and IT workers who work for wages that would be good in their countries but poor by our standards. Outsourcing is a big problem. Given the nature of the technology that we have these days, right. You don't have to go to the office every day and right. do the job.
Well, I think rather than thinking about it as outsourcing, Anne, the way I would just encourage our listeners to think about it today is that we are in a global marketplace for talent. I don't know if you're familiar with the Khan Academy or with a company called Udacity. Battelle's partnering with a company, Udacity. So if I could just take a second and tell you. So Udacity was started by a Stanford professor named Peter Thrun, who was teaching computer programming at Stanford, the exact kind of course we were talking about earlier in this segment. And these are obviously to pretty bright kids, right? You get into Stanford, you're pretty high level, yeah. you're in a computer science, computer coding, programming course. So one day this professor said, you know, I wonder what would happen if I opened it online and let anybody in the world who wanted to sign up for free. I won't give them the same kind of attention and tests, and they won't get credit like our Stanford students do, but we'll open up. So they opened up this class. 160,000 people around the world signed up. 30,000 finished it. 10,000 took a test online to prove that they had, that they had completed it. And I don't remember, I don't want to misquote this, but either the top 50 or the top 100 score on the test didn't come from Stanford students. They came from students all over the world. I have a slide on my slideshow that I talk about this of a 13-year-old in Afghanistan who was dodging mortar fire during the day, had an hour of internet connectivity, and he finished the course. The point is that there are brilliant people all over the world. We now, through the internet, can reach these people. Companies can reach these people. And so we cannot think we have no ability to put a wall around our border and say that a company that's looking for talent only has to look inside of our state of Ohio or inside the United States. It's just not realistic. Khan Academy teaches online courses from math to science to all sorts of things. They've offered 150 million lessons for free worldwide. There's a school in Ghana that just built four walls and uses all free stuff created in the Silicon Valley as their curriculum. So that's the way the world is. We can't go back. We need to be, our students need to be at a level of a global competition. It used to be good enough to be the best student in Columbus, and then maybe you had to be the best student in Ohio. Now you have to be, you have to be at a global level. That's what the STEM movement is about. And we're excited to be a part of it at Battelle.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks.
Eric Fingerhut, Vice President of Education and STEM Learning at Battelle. Coming up, we're going to hear about how they're doing it at OSU and then later on in a local high school. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Are government bans the best way to fight obesity? I'm Neil Conan. Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at New York City's controversial Big Soda ban. Plus, did you know that Americans waste the equivalent of $165 billion worth of food every year? The ugly truth about food waste. That's on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR.
Science Friday this afternoon from 2 to 4 here on 89.7 NPR News. 64 degrees, partly sunny skies. There is a chance of rain late this afternoon, a high of 74. Rain is likely for tonight, a low of 54 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation, thanking WOSU and others who make Columbus a smart and open community. At the Columbus Foundation, personal service and community pride combine to help donors help others through impactful philanthropy, big or small. It's here that history resounds and opportunity abounds. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about how to prepare students for careers in science, technology, engineering, and math, or the so-called STEM fields. Some research has shown that there's a shortage in the United States and that to compete in a global marketplace, we need to be doing a better job. Joining us now to talk about that and a project started by OSU with Community College Partners, Ohio's Science and Engineering Talent Expansion Program, are the co-directors of the Ohio House of Science and Engineering. Dr. David Tomasco, he's Associate Dean of Undergraduate Education and Student Services for the College of Engineering at OSU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us, Susan Olesik. She's Chair of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at OSU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Once again, I want to get to some of our callers, so stay with us. We'll get to you very soon. Just right off the bat, would all of this be necessary if students were properly prepared in high school?
The answer is yes.
Okay. Why?
You have to think of education in the STEM disciplines as a continuum. It builds on everything that you learn starting from elementary school. There's interest and curiosity about the world around you, and science is, and engineering and math is many layers deep. You can't simply think of your high school education as a finishing point. It's really a jumping off point. So, and we have to continue to try to encourage students to be curious about the world around them and pursue more and more details of science, of math, of engineering principles so that they can then move the world forward.
Susan, there's a program this summer. It's been going on for a few years, I gather, at Ohio State to help nurture these students from high school and kind of as a bridge, bring them into college so that they don't hit the brick wall after 6 months or a year. What does that program do that has made a difference?
So this program is specifically for students who are first-generation college students and minority students. This is basically to give them the sense of the rigor that they're going to hit come fall. So we actually bring them through classes that feel very much like fall classes. We calibrate them on what those types of classes are going to feel like. We also bring them through a research project. We want them to feel what science and engineering is actually going to be.
Who are you shooting for when you attract students to this program? Are you shooting for the ones most likely to succeed? Because those, in my mind, are probably the ones that want to get into this program. Or are you shooting for the ones least likely to succeed? How do you make sure you're getting the kids that need it in it instead of just the already really
sure.
high-achieving
gung-ho? We heavily recruit students who are basically on the edge, those students who have performed well in high school, but they are first-generation college students. They don't have the parents who can tell them what college is going to feel like. Minority students who are known to struggle, those students.
Okay. Susanna in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anne, for taking my call, and thank you to everyone on the show. My question is, I'm at OSU currently as a non-traditional returning student. I'm in an engineering program as well. All my German cousins, they all are in internship and apprenticeship programs. It's mandatory for graduation. And I was thinking, with the size of OSU, is there any way that we could, I love the STEM program we have, but can we build on that and make it almost mandatory to have apprenticeship programs or internships?
David Tomasco?
Yeah, we discussed this an awful lot, actually. You know, the line between requiring something for students and providing the opportunities for students to take advantage of co-ops and internships is one that we talk about a lot. We have schools in this state that do require co-op and internship as a part of their degree program. separate from the European system, where they have kind of a five-year degree for an engineering degree. It's almost the equivalent of a combined bachelor's and master's degree here in the U.S. We actively encourage our students in the College of Engineering to do co-ops and internships, and at last count, about 70% of our students will graduate with at least one internship and co-op experience. The philosophy that we follow is to prepare students to get those internships. We have a career services office in the college that starts to provide students the training and the resume workshops and those kind of things to prepare them to get those internships. But we don't require it, because once you require it, it becomes the university's responsibility to put you into something that you may not enjoy. What we want to do is enable you to go out and pursue the types of opportunities that you want. And that way, when it comes time to get permanent employment, you've had the experience of having to interview and get the job that you want.
I would imagine for some students who have to work during the summer and have to work part-time through school, an internship would be a luxury for them, because then it's a full-time job and they have to devote all their time to it. It's an extra semester or quarter or whatever. And that could eliminate a lot of...
Moving from the point where you feel like you've got to work, go back and work that part-time job at Walmart or your lawn service company in the summer, mm-hmm. there's a transition that students have to go through to kind of wean themselves off that comfort level. Yeah, I know I can go back because I know they'll hire me back, and I know that I'm going to get a slight
increase.
And I know
I need the money.
Absolutely. And we try to get them to prepare themselves and think about going to that next job, because the internships that are starting out, if you get an engineering internship, you're going to start somewhere in the $14 an hour range. You're going to make enough money at an internship to pay for any school that you missed and put a little extra money in your pocket. By the time our students do, maybe if they do a co-op program, which is going back to a company more than once, they might be making $18, $20, sometimes $22 an hour that second or third co-op assignment. These students are making really nice money. I mean, they're essentially working real mm-hmm. engineering jobs. The salary differential is amazing. And so once they start to see that, and once they start to get comfortable with their profession, they don't understand why anybody would go back. So but it is a transformation in the way that a student thinks about their employment prospects.
Susanna, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Ann.
Take care. Susan Olisek, there's an opinion out there that most STEM university faculty just don't care about their students' career prospects, that there's a culture out there where they're not nurturing them. They're more concerned about their own research, their own work in the labs and that sort of thing. What's the traditional expectations of faculty in terms of getting their students jobs after graduation? Has that ever been used as some kind of measuring stick of success?
I don't think you could say that your average faculty member is directly monitoring whether the students are successful in getting jobs. We have lots of STEM students, and so it would be hard for an individual faculty member to actually monitor that. Mm-hmm. However, I can tell you that every single faculty member who's a STEM faculty member is very sincere in trying to make sure that those students do well. Faculty members have office hours, and those faculty members clearly want those students to attend those office hours and do well. So your average STEM faculty member, with the exception of engineering, I should say, would not be directly interacting with those students and checking to see if they get degrees or get their jobs, yes.
Is it just because of the way they grew up in the system, or...?
It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the structure of the university for the most part. We are not connected to that part of their career path.
Is that something that could change? Does that make any difference?
So I think this summer bridge program and the whole OSTEP project has been phenomenal in that regard. It has connected STEM faculty member to students in a way that was not happening before. We are directly interacting with these students at a level that's markedly deeper than we would typically interact with students, and that's been an incredible advantage. So STEM, science, math teachers are out there working with those students and learning how they learn these topics and why they're not catching specific pieces of it. So it's been a really good project for both the students and the faculty.
Helping them teach better.
Helping them teach better, yes.
What about other sorts of skills that they're learning in this program?
So I think that in addition to the way that, they're interacting with faculty in the classroom, there's an evening component, which we call the PDPs, or professional development programs, in which we try to get the students engaged in other aspects of college and university life. What's it going to be like to have to live on your own? Where do you go to find resources to, find extra study skills, workshops on test taking? Where are the career services offices for all different types of majors? Who do I talk to if I'm thinking about going into medical school or law school? Where, how do I prepare myself for those kind of things? So all of the service aspects of the university we try to prepare the students for.
Don't they get that in orientation anyway?
What you find, they get a little bit of it in orientation. They get a little bit of it in their survey class. And as educators, what we all find, and of course, I think it's all true of all of us, we retain about 10% of what we hear. The students retain about 10% of what we tell them. So if we tell them multiple times, they retain more and more of it every time we tell them. And it is simply a way to reinforce the things that we do try to tell them and we know is good for them. They don't always, they're not always at the point where they're receptive to hearing it. So what we're trying to do, and this is a battle that we face in the classroom, we face it as educators our whole careers, is what's the most appropriate way and the most effective way to reach the current students that are in front of us?
Because these kids, these students, have a very challenging road ahead of them. This is very difficult stuff to do. And they've made it all fun and games in junior high and to a certain extent in high school, trying to get to the relevancy and why this matters in day-to-day life. But when it comes to college, that's where the rubber meets the road. Right, Susan?
Absolutely. So one thing we've noticed in this program, Ohio State takes in really bright students. So it's not that they don't have the background. There's an incredible maturation process that has to occur during their freshman year. And simply working with these students, you realize, even though they're really bright, the social skills that they have to learn are really substantial in moving from high school to college. That's a big issue.
And yet they're dumped into these gigantic courses.
And yet they're dumped into these gigantic courses. So one of the hallmarks of this program is to show them what it's going to feel like when they get dumped into one of these courses so that it's just not a huge shock.
Andy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Hello. I have a couple of questions, especially about how the OSU is involved, not with the high school. But as an example, Atlanta schools are asking for sixth graders to start the career path because they understand that the middle school probably is where kids with aptitudes and knowledge, or they want to do something in the STEM, can try to reach a level of understanding of STEM. So in Ohio, where we put most of the money in, disability learning, and we do not offer anything for normal class kids that can do much more with help, when the schools are staffed with liberal arts and teachers that have, and even administration that has degrees in discipline, we don't do anything for them.
Okay, all right. Andy, before you go on, I just want to make sure I understand you correctly. You're saying that schools aren't?
Middle schools are not doing enough. Okay. Middle schools where you should start.
Well,
we're talking about high schools, and the reality is we should start in middle school because it takes a long time to really develop skills.
All right, let's hear from Susan Olisek.
So, Andy, I would absolutely completely agree with you on that. There's lots of literature out there that says that, in particular, women will decide for a STEM degree or against a STEM degree in middle school. So middle school is incredibly important in this area, absolutely.
And yet a lot of teachers look at middle schoolers and say they're going through a lot of other stuff, too. It's a very difficult time to try to teach an adolescent.
They are. Talk about the WOW program.
So I'm also the director of the Wonders of the World program. We started this, we finished our 13th year. This is an outreach program that helps elementary school teachers teach science. And so it is a deep collaboration between teachers and scientists. We run professional development projects with the teachers. We bring in volunteer scientists to help the teachers teach the science in their classrooms. We have to teach the kids science from a very young age and continue to teach them all the way through K through 12. So it's not just middle school, it's elementary school, it's high school. It's true that in middle school, all sorts of changes are happening to these kids, but we have to continue to focus on academics too. I completely agree with you.
Andy, thanks a lot for your call. Hello. I appreciate it. Thank you. We have to move on. I just want to thank Susan Olesik, Chair of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at The Ohio State University. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And also David Tomasco. He's Associate Dean of Undergraduate Education and Student Services for the College of Engineering at Ohio State. David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Ann.
They are the co-directors of the Ohio House of Science and Engineering at OSU. For more information, we'll have a link for you on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to hear from an OSU student who's gone through that program and also from an high school teacher who is involved in STEM program locally. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In 1982, Ray Boom Boom Mancini was a champion boxer, colorful, quotable, and popular. Then he killed an opponent in the ring.
I was avoided like the plague. I became the poster boy for everything that was wrong with boxing.
A new book, The Good Son, tells Ray Mancini's story, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition Saturday, tomorrow morning from 8 to 11 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in just about 20 minutes. All Sides Weekend begins and a discussion about fall travel in and around Ohio. Stay with us for All Sides Weekend from 11 till noon. 64 degrees with partly sunny skies. There is a chance of rain late this afternoon, a high of 74 today. Rain is likely for tonight, a low of 54 degrees. Showers likely before noon on Saturday, clouds in the afternoon, a high of 66. And then sunshine on Sunday, a high of 61. Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
All right. We are talking about how to prepare students for careers in science, technology, engineering, and math, or the so-called STEM fields. Some research has shown that there's a shortage in the United States and that to compete in a global marketplace, we need to be doing a better job. We were discussing Ohio's Science and Engineering Talent Expansion Program and the Ohio House of Science and Engineering at OSU. With us now to talk about that from a student perspective is Helen Chen. She's a biology major, will graduate next year, and a participant in the OSTEP Bridge Program in 2009. And then in 2011 was a resident advisor and teaching assistant for the OSTEP Bridge Program at OSU. Welcome to the show, Helen.
Thank you, Anne.
So why did you decide to participate in the program in 2009? When we were talking with Susan Olesik and David Tomasco earlier, they said they really do try to target students who are on the edge, maybe wouldn't quite make it without some extra help. Why did you end up going there?
I ended up going to the OSTEP program because I didn't know how college would be like once I started. I know I went to a very rigorous high school, but I know that college would be different and the classes would be different. At first, I decided to be a biology major, and I know I want to go into the medicine field. However, I wasn't certain of that path, so I felt going into the OSEP program and learning some more stuff about the STEM majors would help me decide what path I want to follow.
It's really hard to attract females to the field. As you know, you probably look around you and can see that's patently obvious. Was that an issue for you, being female in a largely male discipline?
Not at all. I felt that more females should enroll in these type of programs, any summer bridge program that their college is willing to offer. It's a great transition from high school into college. They taught many courses like science, engineering, mathematics, physics. They
During had, that bridge summer yeah, program? Okay.
Even they had a English and writing course, which helped out a lot. Being female did not discourage me at all. It actually encouraged me to push through the program and just do my best.
Because there's such a big demand.
Yes.
Right. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So now you're a mentor, right? Or did I get that wrong? You're a teaching assistant for the OSTEP.
So you, I was, yes.
Okay. So how have you seen it change over the last few years?
Since the first year that I enrolled in it, they started with a mathematics and physics portion. But when I became a math TA for the 2011 year, which was their third year, I believe, I saw a change in the mathematics course, especially. They went from teaching more physics-based math into how to think through problems and not giving you necessarily the right answer, but just helping students work through the process, use their brain, use their own knowledge, rather than saying, okay, this is how you have to do it. Also, I've seen a lot more interaction with the students, the TAs, mentors, and the professors. They work a lot closer, and they try to help students as much as they can. Even after the OSTEP Summer Bridge program, the professors still try to connect with the students and help them become successful, basically, in graduating.
Are you on a track of staying in the university system, getting a master's degree, then going on and getting your PhD and eventually teaching? Or are you on a track where you want to actually go out and get a job outside of academia and succeed in that direction?
I'm more of on the track of graduating with my bachelor's and then hopefully going into med school or getting a master's degree in teaching. There's still options. It's still up in the air right now. But I'm planning on taking the MCAT next year. Even like through my junior year of college, one of the professors still helped me get a tutor through the OSTEP program for my organic chemistry class, and that helped out a lot. He was able to meet with me at any time, and it just helped with the course.
And your career, you're confident there's room for you in the career in terms of medical school if you don't make it, and a certain percentage don't, and I wish you all the luck in the world,
you.
Of course, but there's a drop-off. A lot of people just leave STEM altogether if they don't make it into medical school, if they don't make a certain goal. Is that, what do you think about that, and why is that in your opinion?
I think that especially the students who apply to medical school and don't get in, I think it's just a big, it's discouraging to know that you worked so hard and you were set on that one goal and it just didn't happen for you the first time. But there's always chances to like reapply or take some time off and volunteer at hospitals or anywhere you can find volunteering jobs. You can also do research, which through the OSTEP program, they helped me get an internship at one of the labs on campus, actually. And I think it's just discouraging, but they just have to keep pushing through it and know that there's more that they can do. I don't plan on dropping out of the STEM major at all. I'm going to graduate with a biology degree. And if medical school doesn't work out for me the first time, I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep pushing and reapply. However, if that doesn't work out, I still would like to teach biology at maybe high school, middle school level. So,
also with us now to talk about how STEM efforts work at the high school level is Brian Genius, Worthington City Schools Science and Health Curriculum Leader. Brian has helped to modernize the Worthington Science courses to include material science, STEM physical science, STEM life science, and STEM chemistry. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be here.
So the sciences are fun in middle school. We've been talking about that. But there's a big drop off in interest come high school. You went through the system. What is your estimation of the problem?
Well, you know, we'd love to know the answer to that. We have a great number of students that in the Worthington schools that are engaged in Gateway to Technology courses at our middle schools, which is a part of the Project Lead the Way engineering curriculum. They all get exposed to this. They have a great experience. They love doing it. And when it comes to sign up at our high schools, there's a drop-off. We're kind of caught unexpected by that. And so we've been targeting parents. We've been targeting our students more directly and what their careers and what the future might hold for them, and trying to help them see that this is not simply a lifetime decision that you're in eighth grade, have to make a decision, and you're stuck with it for the rest of your life. There's opportunities to go in and out of our programs, and that the students, they felt at one point that they had to give up other things that were very important to them. For example, their band or strengths.
Well, you know, there is a problem with that program. There's a certain commitment. The classes are set times, and there is a lot of conflict with other courses.
Most definitely. We recognize that, and we have consolidated some of our science courses down to allow students to have extra time periods at the high school so they can continue on with the arts and, those things that make the creativity come out in our students.
Uma in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Anne.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This goes in line with what Brian is telling. And, I am a parent in one of the Dublin schools. What happens is after three Dublin schools, one is a very diversified high school. And recently they have taken, they have like a four teachers for each special education kid, whereas they have taken off AP Physics, AP Computer Science, AP Calculus from this particular Dublin High School, which is a very diversified school,
mm-hmm.
for the same reason that which Brian was telling, that there's not enough enrollment. Then it leaves the kids who really wanted to do these courses out of the whole loop, whereas the other two Dublin schools, which are in a wealthy neighborhood, they are offered this. So when a kid really wants to do these courses, which is AP Physics, AP Comp Science, and AP Calculus, there is no way for them to do this, even though they're all within the Dublin school district. So what can as parents do to bridge this gap? And the administrators make this policy.
Well, Uma, Brian's from the Worthington, but just in general, Brian Genius, what can you tell people if they don't have the luxury of a STEM program like Worthington has? What can parents do to help their kids?
Well, there are an awful lot of outside programs that are available to students. I know annually COSI offers weekend opportunities for engineering and different science hands-on. Ohio State has a huge amount of offering. You heard about a number of the different programs. My daughter actually participated in one called GRASP, in which young women were able to do a physics camp with OSU physics students, and it was wonderful. There's the Women in Engineering program.
But do those things make up for AP courses that everybody wants to get on their record because you do these days?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's actually a replacement available for an AP course. That's a tough decision to make. A lot of times if you pressure the school districts, they will either allow the student to transfer or move over to different schools to get those offerings. I know that happens in Worthington.
You can go between Thomas and Kilbourne.
Worthington Kilbourne mm-hmm. High School, and we do that quite a lot for the students. It's a shame with the budget cuts that are hitting all over the state of Ohio, and the public schools are right there with them. Unfortunately, that's a lot of what gets cut.
Thank you, Uma, for your call.
Thank you.
Good luck. Take care. It's an expensive field to teach in. The technology is constantly changing. You want to keep the kids using the latest kinds of devices, but capital improvement budgets being what they are in a lot of districts, including Worthington, how do you do that?
Well, we've really looked for a lot of outside funding. We have secured, to help get our Project Lead the Way program up and running, we secured a $20,000 grant from the Granger Foundation. We have applied for numerous other grants and trying to make this those types of equipment available. We recently bought a rapid prototyping printer, which is a three-dimensional printer that we share between two high schools that goes back and forth. It's not a cheap device, as you can imagine, but it is an opportunity for kids to see what their images on the computer screen and in their minds actually look like when
these
they come out.
The 3D printers?
3D printer, yeah. And it's pretty exciting. So a lot of that extra technology that needs to be a part of a STEM class is funded by grants and other outside entities.
How do you measure success at this point? And for instance, if a student goes in for his or her freshman year with the STEM program or with the Project Lead the Way or whatever, you know, whatever schools, different schools offer, maybe they decide, you know, this really isn't for me. And they find out then versus by the time they start college. Is that a success too?
Well, I would really hope, you know, students go in to our program thinking about a technical field. And if they realize that it's not for them, that's a great success, especially as a parent paying for college. You don't want to go 3 or 4 years into a college or fail out after a freshman year. You know, that's part of what our public schools are about, is exposing our students to a wide variety of opportunities and different technical fields, the arts, literature, you name it. But if we can have our students learn what they want to do and have some taste of what it's going to be like when they go to college, I would call that a definite success.
How do you prepare how do the teachers prepare to teach these courses? They're different than just straight science or math or...
Most definitely.
Yeah. What kind of extra training do they get?
Any of our teachers that are actually teaching the Project Lead the Way course actually go through a summer workshop to help them learn from the Project Lead the Way instructors, which is a national curriculum. Then we have put together, for example, on our freshman STEM team is a math, science, language arts teacher, and our Project Lead the Way teacher. Along with a history teacher, and they have opportunities to get together during the day and to keep that conversation going. This is what we're talking about. This is the language that we're using. So they're all using and talking in the same vocabulary and towards the same project. So essentially talking about one thing in five classes from different angles.
We're almost out of time, but do you recruit students you see out there that you know have the acumen but maybe don't see it in themselves?
Yes, we do. We look at students' test scores. We look at their achievement. We look at aptitude. We ask teachers in our middle and elementary schools to help identify some of those kids, and we target those kids. And we're really trying to target all students. So this is not just taking the top of the top and saying, look how good we are, but giving an opportunity to all of our students.
Well, thanks for joining us to talk about it, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Genius, he's science and health curriculum leader for Worthington Schools. Also, Helen Chen, thanks for joining us today, Helen.
Thank you.
Helen Chen, she is a participant. She's a biology major graduating next year, participating in Ohio State's OSTEP Bridge Program. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.